God damn, it is nice to be back. It is August 15th, 2019, and this is the QTR Podcast. I've been gone for 10 days, but I got a good one today, and I got an even better one coming this weekend, unless my guest drops off like the rest of my guests this week have done. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm doing my absolute best to book the show and do all the administrative shit at the same time, but every once in a while, you got to just throw your hands up in the air and say, eh, fuck it. You know, just go have a drink and get to it the next day. So it has been a longer gap than I would like in terms of having guests on the podcast. But I got to tell you, even when I had people booked for the last couple of days, today's interview is really the one that I have been looking forward to. I want to remind people first and foremost that this podcast is brought to you by my patrons. My patrons are people that sign up through Patreon and donate a recurring monthly sum to support the podcast. They are single-handedly now what is keeping the podcast going, so I appreciate you guys very much, and I know that my listeners appreciate you too, because you're the guys that keep me going, keep me booking guests, keep me on the air. So I just want to shout out some of my patrons real quick. First and foremost, my friend Pete over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new investor advocacy and investor education service. They do live streams of day trading all day. It was started by a guy who got tired of the traditional day trading services. He thought he was getting taken for a proverbial ride, and I don't necessarily disagree with him. That gentleman's name is Pete. I've talked to him at length, and I've included a link to his new service, Watchlist Live Stream, Investor Education, The Trader's Path. It is a pretty much a no-bullshit trading service, is how I would describe it. Link is in my podcast description. Also, my friends over at Sang Lucci Trading, I want to shout them out. They right now are doing two separate things that are of interest. The first is they just released something called the 3LT Playbook, which is their guide on how Sang Lucci became the seven-figure fucking stud he is today. And Lucci is a good buddy of mine, as is his partner, Charlie, who will actually be on the podcast hopefully in September. Check out the 3LT Playbook by them for their insight as to the three strategies that Lucci has kind of found out has gotten him to where he is today. They also do a master course for investor education, which I highly recommend. I have checked that out myself. It's fantastic. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends at Rumorhound. Rumorhound.ai is a new AI-based piece of software that helps you distinguish which rumors on merger and acquisitions are credible and which ones may be less credible. It's a great tool to have in your arsenal of trading tools on a daily basis. They're offering a free 14-day trial, and that link is also in my podcast description. Also want to shout out a new patron, my friends over at Focused Compounding. Focused Compounding, you can check them out on Twitter at Focused Compounding, and there's a link to their Twitter, their YouTube, and their podcast also in my podcast description. All these guys focus on, folks, are investment opportunities and names that are overlooked by the rest of the market. So they're digging in the nooks and crannies, just like in your fucking English muffin in the morning, to find the things that the mainstream has avoided. So check out my friends over at Focused Compounding. Their information is in my podcast description. I also want to shout out my friends at Hella Bacon, who shoot machine guns from helicopters in Texas. My friends over at Corvus Gold. My friend Piggly Wiggly, Nate at Investors Underground. Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, Nicholas Parks on the left coast, Matthew Zimmer, and my longtime homeboy Russ Valenti. I also want to shout out the patrons that have signed up since my last podcast. Craig Schwartz, Dominic Reinman, Steve Letkowski, my friend Carson, my buddy Marco Vitti is still in the house. J.K. Cunningham just re-upped. I appreciate you, my friend, very much. Valentin Baker Posh is in the house. Andrew Kuhn, my friends at Verified Exchange running New Generation Classifieds. Gaz Harkness is in the house. Mac Martin and Peter Browning are still here. My buddy James is here. James Cottom, another James. Max Bulduk, what's going on, my brother? Paul Isaac and Justin Toner, and some of my longtime patrons that have been with me for a while, like Conspirer Carrot, I still see you. Steven Rasputik, I appreciate you. Andrew Lindner, William Sumfest, my friend Money Lobster, I still see you, my good friend. I see you on Twitter too, brother. Ned DeLorme is still in the house. How about Colin Turner, Travis Davis, and finally, my friend Eric Penner? Thank you guys so much for your continued support of the podcast. Finally, this podcast is not investment advice, and most importantly today, I have a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. Now, I gotta say, this is a podcast that I have been looking forward to doing since I heard about the work of this journalist, Whitney Webb, which was last weekend. I was sitting at a bar enjoying my Sunday, I think, and somebody got in touch with me and said, this is the person that you need to have on if you want to talk Epstein. And I have been kind of holding out over the course of the week, diving into anything Jeffrey Epstein related, because I started to peruse Whitney's work, which is astonishing. I actually read, she has a series of articles out on Mint Press News that are insanely in-depth, and she knows the subject matter extremely well. I read probably half of them and was extremely impressed, and I wanted to wait to have her on to go kind of from the beginning, because I realized that my listeners aren't going to have read this prior to the podcast. So Whitney Webb is a Mint Press News journalist. She's based in Chile. She's contributed to several independent media outlets, including Global Research, EcoWatch, the Ron Paul Institute, and 21st Century Wire, among others. She's made several radio and television appearances and is the 2019 winner of the Serena Shim Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism. That's pretty badass. How are you, Whitney?
Thanks. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. It is awesome to have you on, and I really appreciate it. And I didn't know that you were involved with the Ron Paul Institute. That is awesome as well.
Yeah, well, they republish my work a lot, and Daniel McAdams is awesome. And my longtime dream is to be invited to an interview on the Liberty Report. So we'll see if that happens.
We're going to get you there, because I'm like 2 degrees of separation away from those guys. So somebody's going to hear this podcast, and I know people that have interviewed Ron Paul, and I know people that are close with him. So let's get Whitney on there, and hopefully this will be the podcast that does it for you. Ron Paul is a huge hero of mine. You know, I was on his street team back when he ran for president a long time ago.
Oh, awesome. In 2012?
Yes. And I think also in 2008.
That was the last time I voted.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for Ron Paul.
Is that when you moved to Chile after that?
Yeah, I moved in 2012 after I graduated, a few months after I graduated from university.
Ah. So where were you living in the States when you were here?
Well, I was going to grad school in Kentucky, but I didn't like the program, so I ended up leaving, I think around October. It was more like, it was at the end of the semester.
Awesome.
So I made plans to leave, and then not that long after, you know, I'm trying to remember the timeline. I haven't really thought about this in a long time, but yeah, it was near the end of 2012. I lived in Peru, and then later came down to Chile. I used to work in Cusco. And tourism translation writing stuff. So,
did you ever drink ayahuasca in Peru?
No, I didn't do ayahuasca because it's actually really expensive. And I was making like Peruvian money, which is, you know, compared to the US dollar is doesn't have nearly as much purchasing power. And it was priced mostly for American tourists, right? So I didn't really get to do that.
If you want to live vicariously through somebody, I just did a podcast with my friend Sang Lucci, who just came back from Costa Rica, and we documented his ayahuasca experience. That's sad that that's the only thing I know about Peru, unfortunately.
Oh, right. Well, that's why most people go, actually, these days. So, you know, that would make sense. So no worries.
So your work, when it was recommended to me by somebody who I trust implicitly and somebody who I think is brilliant, said that it is it's the best out there on Epstein. And I read your part 3 of your series, which really confirmed to me that you have a very serious grasp on the subject matter. So I wanted to kind of take things slowly and piece by piece with the Epstein story, because a lot's happened since then, too. And first and foremost, just kind of wanted to ask you how you got involved in covering Jeffrey Epstein to begin with.
Okay, well, I wasn't actually planning on covering Jeffrey Epstein when the arrest was made. It was only really after Alex Acosta, you know, made that, or it came out in the press anyway, the mainstream press, right, that he had made that claim that Epstein had been linked to intelligence when he had to explain to Trump's transition team or you know, Trump officials why he had, you know, approved that, you know, so-called sweetheart deal with Epstein when he was first arrested.
Right.
And so when that came out, I was working on a totally separate report on you know, a totally different subject matter. I was writing about, like, Christian Zionism in the U.S. or something, just not related very much at all. And so I you know, just personally wanted to know, you know, what intelligence agency it was, because it was really vague, the statement, right? It was just said he belonged to intelligence. And it wasn't clear if it was American intelligence or it was another intelligence agency. And, of course, a lot of people had speculated that it could have been, right, the Mossad or Israeli intelligence, because of, you know, his close relationship to Ghislaine Maxwell, who, of course, her father is well known to have been a Mossad operative, among other things. So I figured that I could maybe get a, you know, an angle on this to write about, you know, intelligence ties if I went back into the history of sexual blackmail operations. And so I was reading this book by Doug Valentine, who is an awesome researcher into CIA covert operations. And I came across a passage in there where he was talking about Mayor Lansky, who's this, you know, really famous organized crime figure, that he was sending women to Mexico to entrap American diplomats visiting back in 1939 in, like, bugged hotels to use as blackmail, right? And then I knew from separate reporting that Lansky was tied into the Bronfman family going way back, going into Prohibition, and that he was really close to Sam Bronfman. And of course, Samuel Bronfman's granddaughters were recently implicated in the NXIVM cult. So I started reading about the Bronfman family. And in a book about the Bronfmans, there was this part about not Bronfman, but another, you know, liquor baron of the Prohibition era that was actually an American named Louis Rosensteel, and how he had been involved in a sexual blackmail operation that involved J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI and Roy Cohn, who at the time this was going on, or started anyway, or at the beginning of Cohn's involvement in this. He was general counsel to Senator Joe McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings. And so I thought that was really nuts because, of course, Roy Cohn is best remembered for being, these days anyway, for being a mentor to Donald Trump and Roger Stone and some people like that. And is often remembered sort of as this mob lawyer, but the more you look into the guy, he was super powerful in Washington, even after he sort of had that fall from grace a bit in the McCarthy hearings. I mean, in the Reagan White House, I mean, he was a big deal. He was super influential during that period. And I thought it was strange that, you know, and because there's so many mainstream media organizations that will publish anything salacious about Trump, that they somehow didn't publish this, even though it's documented. I mean, I point out in my report that there is just an overwhelming amount of evidence about Roy Cohn running a sexual blackmail operation targeting powerful people involving boys, underage boys, and that he did this for decades. And this has never come out in mainstream reporting on Roy Cohn. It just, you know, tries to play up his mob ties and be like, oh yeah, Trump's tied into the mob, but they didn't cover this. And I think that's really telling, because of course, having to bring that, air out that dirty laundry, you know, if you pull on that thread, as I started to do in part two and in part three, and I'll continue to do in the last part of my series, which is coming out soon, you start to, you know, uncover the fact that this wasn't just, you know, these weren't just isolated sickos, right? This is part of a network that has connections to intelligence. Some of them have connections to intelligence in multiple countries. And this has been going on for a long time, and the CIA has never been held accountable for it, nor have any of the other players besides the CIA, you know, been held accountable. And that's why someone like Jeffrey Epstein was allowed to happen and was never brought to justice wasn't brought to justice for so long. And, you know, why he got that sweetheart deal and why, so now that he's, you know, dead or whatever, so many people close to him haven't been pursued to the full extent of the law, and they haven't even been found, right? The other day it was Ghislaine Maxwell's in Boston, and then it's like, no, she's not in Boston, she's in France. So, you know, it's just all these stories to like keep people off balance. I almost feel like, because in the mainstream press, everything that has come out since Epstein has died, depending on the outlet, I mean, they're all like contradictory. Like, it was a murder, it was a suicide. Ghislaine Maxwell was found. No, she wasn't. You know, Leslie Wexler's bad. No, he's not. It's it's just kind of a mess right now. But anyway, that's how I got started, and that's more or less sort of a I guess an overview, generally speaking, of the series also.
Cool. So let's go back and kind of pick some of that apart, because part of the reason too that I wanted to not read parts one and two after I read part three is I probably shouldn't have read part three first, but I had trouble keeping up with the names, and right. I'm having trouble doing that already now. But let's just circle back to the beginning and talk about the fact that we kind of matter-of-factly passed over this notion that Epstein was involved with intelligence, which is something that sure as hell don't remember reading on, you know, CNN or in the mainstream media. So what do those ties look like? How rock solid are they, or how circumstantial are they? And why is Whitney Webb covering this and CNN isn't? Or am I mistaken?
Well, I think it's a pretty easy to figure out why I'm covering this and CNN is not, because I mean, if you are, you know, uncovering stuff related to intelligence that the intelligence community does not want to come out, generally speaking, mainstream media is relatively compliant, or always compliant, depending on the outlet. So I think that would explain that. As sorry, what was the other part of your question?
Well, I just kind of want to know if you can simplify and make an easy to kind of follow case for Epstein's ties to intelligence. So you mentioned Maxwell, Maxwell's father.
Right. So the ties to intelligence thing, right? It wasn't said what intelligence agency it was. It was assumably intentionally left to be pretty vague. So it's kind of hard to condense the case I'm making, which is currently at like 60 pages or something, into something, you know, short and sweet. But I also want to point
out, we have as much time as you want.
Okay. Well, I also want to point out too that when we're talking about intelligence agencies, right? If you are looking for some sort of like signed affidavit of Jeffrey Epstein saying I work for this intelligence agency and blah blah blah, the CIA doesn't do that sort of thing. They fight tooth and nail to keep anything from coming out. I mean, just look at what happened with the Church Committee, and how the CIA hasn't really been like meaningfully investigated since. And anytime they declassify something, it comes out decades after something happens or after a scandal breaks. So I just want to point that out. So what I'm trying to do here is go back now that we know that he was tied to some elements of intelligence, whatever they were,
right?
Try and look into his history and see who he was connected to and what types of intelligence agencies may have been involved there. So going back into Epstein's past, and you know, I'm also talking in my series, I'm not just talking about Epstein, because there's a lot of other sexual blackmail rings that involve children that are part of this, that share a lot of the same connections to these same intelligence agencies and some of the same figures, right? But Epstein in particular, after he dropped out of college, he was hired to go to the Dalton School. And even though the Daily Beast originally said that it was Donald Barr, and then they said it wasn't Donald Barr, but then they corrected and said it was Donald Barr, right? So from what we know, at least at this point, Donald Barr is the guy that hired Jeffrey Epstein at the Dalton School, even though he was a college dropout. So Donald Barr is William Barr's father, and Donald Barr also worked at the OSS, or the Office of Strategic Services, which is the forerunner to the CIA. And another interesting fact here is that a year before Barr, you know, allegedly hired Epstein, he wrote this weird kind of trashy sci-fi book about sex slavery and human trafficking. So that's kind of bizarre. When you consider everything else that's come out.
Yeah, so totally normal, right?
Right.
Everybody's got one of those in their catalog.
Right. Right. The book is called Space Relations.
Mm-hmm.
so it's just, naturally. It's just bizarre. Right. So anyway, he gets fired from the Dalton School. And there's been some, Epstein does.
Okay.
Well, Barr does too. He leaves in 1974.
Okay.
And Epstein leaves a few years later, allegedly for misconduct or not being a good enough teacher. I mean, there's been sort of some contradictory reports based on who the sources were for that. But anyway, after he leaves the Dalton School, he gets hired by Alan Greenberg. Or Ace Greenberg, to go work at Bear Stearns. And Alan Greenberg, I mentioned Roy Cohn earlier. Alan Greenberg was a super close friend of Roy Cohn. He hosted an honorary dinner of B'nai B'rith, some sort of State of Israel bonds dinner. I forget the exact title of it. But Roy Cohn's father had been served a major leadership role in B'nai B'rith. And the honorary chairman of this dinner were Rupert Murdoch, Donald Trump, and Alan Greenberg, who were super tight with Cohn. And as I mentioned, Cohn was involved in these sort of sexual blackmail activities and a ring that ran for a really long time and really one of the pioneers of that sort of activity, at least in terms of, the government's involvement in that. Alan Greenberg hires him at Bear Stearns, and then after that, he leaves Bear Stearns in 1981. And according to Vicki Ward, who's been a journalist that's, wrote about Epstein before he was even arrested and has been on his tail for a long time, he became a bunch of her sources told her that he had became a financial bounty hunter for governments and powerful people. But there was another guy that investigated Epstein before his arrest. He was a British journalist named Nigel Rosser, writing for the Evening Standard, and he reported in 2001 that Epstein had previously stated that during the early 1980s, he was working for the CIA. So during the early 1980s, what we do know is that he was one of his clients when he was doing this financial bounty hunter type of deal was Adnan Khashoggi, who's this famous...
Hold on one second. Let me stop you. Explain financial bounty hunter. And just unpack just a little bit.
So it's kind of hard to explain in the sense that there isn't that much information about what exactly he was doing. And that is the term that Epstein used to describe what he was doing to his friends at the time.
Okay.
That he was this financial bounty hunter. So basically what he said he would do is he would find money that powerful people or governments thought had been embezzled. And he would also hide money for presumably tax evasion purposes, things like that, for those same powerful people. So to me, I think he may have this is speculation on my part, because again, we don't have a lot of details here. This is just sources coming from journalists and what they're citing. I haven't talked to Vicki Ward sources myself, right? But it appears that he may have been involved in money laundering. He also had a really long time association with Deutsche Bank, which is in all sorts of problems,
right?
And has been the subject of money laundering probes. And he was also really close to Lynn Forrester, to Rothschild, who also has a long-standing ties to Deutsche Bank as well, and used to be a Deutsche Bank advisor.
Where would Epstein get the knowledge of how to do this stuff? Like, how do you get your
apparently
how do you get
at
your
Bear
start?
Stearns, because this is where he went after Bear Stearns, right? And so he got involved in all this stuff. And, the fact that he was involved with someone like Adnan Khashoggi in the early 1980s, I think, is really telling, because I'm sure a lot of people remember that Adnan Khashoggi was very involved in Iran-Contra in the early 1980s. And according to former Mossad agent Victor Ostrovsky, who wrote this book called By Way of Deception about the Mossad that Israel considered so damaging, they tried to prevent its publication. He said that Khashoggi had been on the payroll of Mossad several years before Iran-Contra began, and that was by those first weapon deals that had been brokered, that were brokered partially by Khashoggi and another Iranian guy. That was going on in 1981, so presumably before then he was already connected or on the payroll of the Mossad, Khashoggi was. So at this time, he's, you know, Epstein is working for Khashoggi, and he's doing these sort of financial services, right? Covert financial services for powerful people behind the scenes.
Yeah, and weird, so, kind of like, which we don't even know what they are, right? Financial services, quote unquote, like...
Well, this is what he was telling people close to him what he was doing, right? I mean, so take that for what you will. But, you know, the fact that he was working for Khashoggi has been cited as the reason that his residence on this weird Austrian passport that was found was listed as Saudi Arabia. Because normally, in order to get an Austrian passport, you have to have residence in Austria. And this passport listed his residence as being in Saudi Arabia. And it showed that he traveled to Saudi Arabia on several occasions, or at least the passport did. It had stamps for entering and leaving that country in several European destinations, really going all over the place, doing these sort of activities. And I think the fact that he used to claim, according to this British journalist anyway, that he had been affiliated with the CIA, especially during this early 1980s period, and involved with people like Adnan Khashoggi, who were involved in sort of like these intelligence operations like Iran-Contra and things like that. I think that is a very significant indicator that, you know, these ties to intelligence that Acosta referenced, you know, there really may be that this may be where that, you know, came from to an extent, and that he began, he had an association with some of these agencies, and that later developed and tended towards sexual blackmail when he met up with Ghislaine Maxwell shortly after her father's death in 1991.
Interesting. Let me stop you right there. So we're at now, and geez, you remind me of myself when I get pissed off about economics and I start talking about the Fed, because it's just one long sentence that just never fucking ends. And like, on one hand, I want to be like, hey, maybe just slow down a little
bit. It's a lot of info.
But on the other hand, I'm like, I know exactly how you fucking feel, because you've been immersed in this and you're like balls deep in it, and you just want to get everybody all the knowledge from your brain into their ears. So like, just where we're at, right? Epstein has these ties to intelligence, right? This money kind of starts appearing out of nowhere, or so he claims he's doing these kind of nebulous financial services for people. He's surrounded by people that have a history of sexual blackmailing, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. And also, so after this, after he stops doing this sort of activity,
real quick, and I'm sorry, one more point I just want to flesh out just for my listeners, is you were saying earlier before too that people that are involved in intelligence, specifically with the CIA, you know, you think there's no signed affidavit, there's no CIA pay slips. And I think there was
there may be in the CIA's files, but they won't release them willingly.
Right. But as far as they're concerned, he doesn't work for them, right? Or he's not involved.
Yeah, I mean, they always deny everything. That they denied Iran-Contra. They pretty much every scandal the CIA's ever been involved in, they deny.
Okay, right. Keep going. I don't want to stop you. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, it's cool. So anyway, that's just Epstein's like relatively early career. So after that, he meets up with Leslie Wexner. Depending on the report you read, it either says 1985 or 1986. But either way, Leslie Wexner then becomes his main financial patron.
And who's
Leslie
she?
Wexner, so it's a man. He's the guy that owns Victoria's Secret.
Oh, okay. Oh,
Les Wexner. That's why he uses the nickname, but his full name is Leslie Wexner. Apparently, Leslie used to be like a boy name, too, back in the day.
Yeah.
I don't know. So anyway, he... Leslie Wexner meets him and is apparently like so taken with him that he, you know, eventually gives him like, you know, all this control over his financial affairs, gives him permission to hire and fire people, puts him on the board of his foundation, does all this other stuff. And so while that's going on, another side deal that, or I guess side business, you could say, that Epstein gets involved in the light beginning in 1987 is with Steve Hoffenberg and Tower Financial, which is considered one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in American history. And it collapsed in 1993 and defrauded its customers of like $450 million, somewhere in that ballpark, somewhere in there. And according to court documents, Hoffenberg put a lot of the blame for the whole operation you know, and the fraud and all of that on Epstein. And there was a lot of information, internal information from the company blaming Epstein, but then Epstein's name mysteriously gets dropped from the case, suggesting at that time that he has friends in high places that can, you know, get him out of sticky situations, right? So that was in a 1993 court filing. But anyway, Leslie Wexner, I want to talk about a little bit, because Leslie Wexner is the same year he met Jeffrey Epstein, actually, there was a very mysterious murder in Columbus, Ohio. Remember that he is like, Leslie Wexner lives in Ohio and is like the richest man in that state, basically. So there's this really suspect murder in Ohio. It was described as a mob style murder. This lawyer, Arthur Shapiro, got like shot in the face in broad daylight while he was knocking on some apartment door. It turned out later that he was due to testify in court about tax evasion. And at the time, he was representing L Brands, which was Wexner's company.
Right.
Yeah. And there was this police report based on the investigation into Arthur Shapiro's death that was suppressed. And the reason given is that the police chief said he considered the results of the murder investigation to be libelous against powerful businessmen in the Columbus area. And so this report never saw the light of day until by accident, I think in 1998, when this journalist, Bob Fitrakis, filed a freedom information or a public records request with the police department in Columbus. And by accident, they gave him like a copy of this police report. And in that police report, it names Leslie Wexner as being an affiliate of organized crime syndicates, specifically the National Crime Syndicate and the Genovese crime family and a bunch of people that had been connected to Mayor Lansky's mob, though at that time Mayor Lansky was dead. But, you know, people obviously continued his criminal, you know, enterprises and businesses after him. So I think
this guy is murdered, and they say they're not going to release the police report because it would be, you know, libelous to somebody. You know, meanwhile, a police report is objective evidence, right? So by virtue of that, it's not libelous. They said it would be libelous to somebody. Then all of a sudden it slips out. And by the way, it's got this guy Wexler's name attached to it, saying that he's an affiliate of organized crime. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. But that didn't come out until like the late 90s, and it was by accident. And it didn't really get much traction out of Ohio, this reporting.
Because it was all over and done with, right?
Yeah, because it had happened so long ago. But anyway, Arthur Shapiro's homicide technically is unsolved up until today. Okay. No one knows who did it officially.
All right.
Oh, sorry. My connection went out for a second.
Oh, that's okay. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? Okay, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. All
right. Okay, so where was I?
We were just talking about
go ahead. Yeah, I got it. Sorry, it took me just a sec. So anyway, he meets up with Wexner and has a side thing with Hoffenberg, right? And so in 1989, Wexner buys this mansion in Manhattan, which is this townhouse that Jeffrey Epstein lived in and that was raided after his arrest recently, right? Wexner buys it in 1989 for like $13 million. He never lives in it, but he spends millions of dollars furnishing it. And one of the things he puts in this house is this super weird bathroom that's hidden like under the stairs. It's like in that, space under the stairs.
Right.
And you open it up and it's all, the walls are all lined with lead. And then you open up like the cabinets and there's like CCTV of inside the house and like all this, you know, weird recording equipment, and there's like a secure, there's like phones and stuff. It's not something you would spend so much money, you know, why would you make that for a house you would never live in? And then this house, you know, Epstein starts to live in it by like apparently like the mid 1995, he's already living there and has been living there for a while. And then years later, it's transferred to Epstein for a dollar from Wexner to I think it was a trust that was owned by Epstein. So during this time, Epstein claimed to be running like consulting services in a hedge fund, basically. But after his recent arrest, people said the hedge fund like didn't exist. They never did business with it. They never like traded with Epstein. No one had really heard of him. They didn't think the hedge fund existed. And his only known client of his like consulting firm was publicly known was Leslie Wexner. So what I'm inclined to believe is that, you know, this guy was set up to look like a billionaire and had a bunch of money, but it didn't come from him. You know, and he was given this stuff. He was given this apartment. He may have been given his other residences or the money to buy those other residences. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, believed he was a billionaire. But as the evidence has come out, especially in recent weeks, he doesn't really seem to have been making the money himself. And actually people that, according to victim depositions and people that were familiar with his exploitation of these girls, he spent so much time, you know, like having sex that he had no time to actually work to make money. Like exploiting and abusing these girls was his like full-time job, basically, or like entertaining these famous people at his island or you know, at his townhouse or whatever. So that to me raises more red flags, because why would you spend millions of dollars setting someone up with like this house, you know, with the spy equipment in it, for no other, I mean, why would you do that if this guy wasn't, you know, a front for something or working for some sort of shady organization, whether it's intelligence or something else?
To go back to the house, the claim that you're making is that there was a secret spot underneath the stairs where people could go in, and basically the whole house was on camera. And there were like phones, and basically it was made out of lead, and it was a secret compartment.
Lined with lead. But yeah, and this was before Epstein lived in it. This was when Wexner was refurbishing it before Epstein even lived in the house.
So do you think Wexner was involved in some type of activity that would warrant that also?
Yeah. Yeah, well, Wexner is the one that paid for it.
Right.
Why did he do that? Right. Yeah.
What's the purpose of the lead? What does the lead room do?
No electronic surveillance, like the signals of the electronics don't come in or out, from my understanding.
Ah, interesting.
All of this, by the way, is in a New York Times article from 1996 that talks about what the Times describes as the strange trend of these super billionaires buying penthouses and never living in them. Or something.
That is,
and
a strange,
you know,
trend.
The other, right? I know, it's super weird. And one of the other guys cited in that article is Ron Perlman, the guy that owns Revlon, and he also comes up in Jeffrey Epstein's like book of contacts or whatever. So that's weird. It's a weird little side connection. I didn't include that in my reports, but
that is interesting.
But yeah, it's definitely
because like L Brands, that's another female based kind of. Revlon's a makeup company, but L Brands is a woman's brands, right? Obviously, Victoria's Secret's a woman's brand.
Yeah,
and they're both C-suite guys.
Preteen brands also, like Abercrombie and Fitch. I believe that's mostly marketed to like preteens. That's also a Leslie Wexner-owned company, Bath and Body Works. And apparently Epstein at his like residences on the islands and stuff, he would have like tons of Victoria's Secret underwear that he would like give to girls and stuff. And on some occasions he played up his association with Victoria's Secret to try and get close to certain women, at least in the late 90s, saying that he could maybe like get them a modeling job with Victoria's Secret. And I don't really go into this in my reports because I'm focusing more on the like intelligence, sexual blackmail angle. But there's a lot of involvement of these like modeling agencies, of different modeling agencies sort of in the trafficking and I guess procuring of these girls to be part of this ring. And it's global. You know, it's like modeling agencies all over the world. Really sick stuff.
So where do we leave off? Where do we go from there?
Okay, so I'm just talking about like, you know, Wexner and how this guy was like set up to look like he was, you know, rich and making all these billions of dollars, and it was because he was, you know, super smart or whatever. Like that's the official narrative, right? And so what I just explained, you know, is a pretty effective way to debunk like the narrative that's come out in the mainstream press in the past few weeks, that basically Epstein hoodwinked all these billionaires and people that gave him money or were, you know, associated with him, specifically Leslie Wexner, and you know, blaming Epstein for all of that, and saying Leslie Wexner didn't know about anything, because there's actually even more evidence that that's not true. There was this artist named Maria Farmer that was hired by Epstein to do work, artwork in a home owned by Wexner in Ohio. And according to Farmer, Epstein sexually assaulted her, and she called the police, and she tried to leave the property, but Wexner's personal security guards wouldn't let her leave for like 12 hours or something like that. So for Wexner not to have known would have been quite odd. And actually, on Alan Dershowitz, of all people, in an interview with TRT World, he said that Leslie Wexner had been accused by at least like 7 victims of raping them. And remember, Dershowitz himself is accused of rape. Dershowitz was attempting to say that, like, the allegations are ridiculous because, look, they even accused Leslie Wexner and he's so great or something. I think that was his reasoning there. But, I mean, the fact that he'd been accused of that and all this other stuff that I've already mentioned I think definitely debunks the fact that Leslie Wexner had no idea what was going on and just gave this guy control of his, you know, billions of dollars for like more than 2 decades and like just had no idea it was being used for any of this stuff, and then gives him this, you know, bugged out townhouse for free, basically. It's just, that story is complete crap to me.
Yeah, well, that's just not normal shit that happens, you know? It's just, right? You don't have to know anything about Epstein or anything about the controversy here or any of that background information. Like, it's just not a normal thing to do, to buy a mansion with a secret compartment with CCTV and lead fucking walls and then turn around and break it off to this guy for a dollar. I mean, you don't need to know anything else aside from that. So take us now into, you know, like late 90s, early 2000s, kind of how this story progressed.
Okay. So, So Wexner is like creating this townhouse in the early 90s, right? That eventually gets into, that is eventually just given to Epstein, or Epstein just starts to live in it.
What year did he start to live in it?
He had been living in it for years, according to the 1996, a few years, according to the 1996 New York Times article. So it's not known. I mean, it could have been 1993. It could have been 1995. I mean, it's not clear, but that's what that article says. So it was before 1996, but Wexner bought it in 1989. So somewhere in there, it happened.
Okay.
So it's not exactly clear. We'd probably have to ask Epstein, sure, or Wexner.
No problem.
But we can't ask Epstein, right?
or maybe we can.
Maybe. Some people think that. Oh, crap. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there again. Oh, right. Okay, so in the early 90s, Epstein was with... this was when he first started to get involved with politicians directly. He got pretty involved with the Clintons starting in 1993. Actually, he became a donor to the White House Historical Association. He met with the deputy chief of staff at the Clinton White House during 1993, like around 3 or 5 times, somewhere in that ballpark. Lynn Forrester, well, now she's Lynn Forrester to Rothschild. Sorry, but at the time, she was Lynn Forrester, and she, in a letter to Bill Clinton in 1995, said, "Oh, it was so nice to see you at Ted Kennedy's house." And she talked about how she said that she had briefly spoken to Clinton during what she called her 15 seconds of access, right? Because he's the president, so she can't talk to him for long. And the stuff she says that she talked to him about was Jeffrey Epstein and currency manipulation, or not manipulation, currency trading.
Okay.
I forget the exact term, but something about like currency stuff, which is interesting because the stuff that he liked to say that he did with Deutsche Bank was currency trading. And
right,
that he thought he was so great at game currency markets, he used to like brag about it to people. So
he was so great
apparently
at what?
He claimed that he was great at like gaming currency markets
gaming,
or whatever.
Okay.
But this was in the early 2000s, he was just really good at making bets on, I don't know,
yeah, just exactly like Hillary Clinton with cattle futures, just very, very good at those things.
Yeah, right. So in 1995, Lynn Forrester is discussing Jeffrey Epstein with Bill Clinton in relationship to currency markets, basically, or currency stabilization. Sorry, I think that's the term she used. I'd have to look at the letter again. But that's super odd, isn't it? Because most of the mainstream press about Epstein and Clinton says that relationship began in after Clinton had left office, but actually it was going on while he was in office. And you know, Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell appeared at donor dinners for Clinton, and then they later got involved with some other politicians close to Bill Clinton. Well, after Clinton, like Bill Richardson, and Lynn Forrester had a relationship with Bill Richardson because she was on his advisory council when he was Secretary of Energy under Clinton. So he got really involved with these political circles, but he also knew Donald Trump during this time, right? And my hypothesis for them knowing each other is because they were in New York, right? And as I mentioned, Roy Cohn was really close to Trump, and they clearly swam in the same circles. And I, as I mentioned earlier, I believe that Jeffrey Epstein, considering that he was in New York during a lot of this time in the late 80s and early 90s, was also swimming in these same social circles. So that's how I think they knew each other. Okay. But I think that the ties to the Clintons, politically anyway, you know, that happened in the early 90s and continued well into the 2000s. And, you know, of course, he rode on the plane. Bill Clinton rode on the Lolita Express and all this stuff going on, you know, several years after Clinton left office. So, yeah. Also during this time in the late 90s, Clinton gets, you know, has the Lewinsky affair and all this stuff. And he was, you know, a lot of stuff going on in his administration was also targeted by Israeli espionage specifically. In 1997, there was like this mega spy scandal that broke in the Washington Post, and Mossad agents in the U.S. were trying to get this document pertaining to Israeli-Palestine peace negotiations the U.S. was brokering and that Clinton was involved in. They wanted this document, and he asked his superior in Tel Aviv in this conversation that was intercepted by the NSA if he could go and get it from Mega, right? And no one knew who Mega was, and they thought it was this individual spy, you know, Jonathan Pollard and all of that, or someone like Jonathan Pollard, who, you know, was that convicted spy for Israel that used to work for U.S. Naval Intelligence. But then the Mega Group, then it's revealed a year later in the Wall Street Journal that there's this group of high power billionaires that was founded in 1991 by Leslie Wexner and Charles Bronfman, that was known as the Mega Group, and it were these super influential oligarchs, basically oligarchs both in the U.S. and Israel, that are mostly known for their like philanthropic causes. And as I point out in my reports, pretty much like the vast majority of their members have some sort of ties to the same organized crime syndicate that I mentioned earlier on the podcast, right? So some examples I mentioned, Leslie Wexner has those ties, allegedly had ties in that police report. Another person would be the Bronfman family. I already mentioned that the Bronfman family, Edgar and Charles Bronfman, were in the Mega Group. Their family has longstanding ties to the Lansky Syndicate going back to Prohibition. Another person, Max Fisher, used to work for, when he was younger, was a bagman for the Detroit Purple Gang, which was connected to Lansky as well. And there's a bunch of other members of that group that also had similar mob ties. Even Steven Spielberg actually was the protege of Lou Wasserman, who used to work for Mo Dalitz, who's another crime figure based in Ohio. And Lou Wasserman was also a major political backer of Ronald Reagan, and he's best known for being the head of Universal MCA, you know, for several decades. So that's a pretty odd connection there going on in 1997. And then also it was actually Netanyahu who first obtained calls of Clinton and Lewinsky, Monica Lewinsky, these steamy phone calls, and he attempted to use that as leverage over her. So given that Ghislaine Maxwell and Epstein were going on, you know, were involved in this and involved in the Clinton White House to an extent, you know, during this time, I think, you know, the claims of Ghislaine Maxwell's father and the Mossad and the fact that there's this, you know, sort of Israeli espionage effort in some ways to sort of get leverage over Clinton going on during this time. I think that's kind of an interesting overlap. But
yeah, how does Ghislaine first get involved? How does she enter the scene?
She starts dating Epstein in the early 90s. They meet in 1991.
Got it.
Sorry, I should have said that. And no, she was attending all of these donor functions. She was attending all of these donor functions with Epstein. Yeah.
Okay, so keep
from
going.
From the very beginning. Yeah, so I'm basically, this is clearly speculative, and I'm not making this claim in my report either, but I think it's an interesting overlap, and I also think it's interesting that during this time, a lot of the same players in some of the networks or the network that I lay out, including the Mega Group and some other individuals were very that were connected to Epstein later, like Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel, were super influential in getting Bill Clinton to pardon Mark Rich, who's this other sort of Iran-Contra figure that was linked to the Mossad that didn't get a pardon in 1991 with most of the other Iran-Contra figures that, of course, Bill Barr helped orchestrate. So I think there may be more to that angle there, but given that it's, you know, mostly circumstantial, I'm not making that claim in my report, but I think it's some interesting overlap of things that were going on in that timeline when we're considering the, you know, the intelligence angle of Epstein and whether it was CIA or Mossad or the mob, right? I think, honestly, that there were elements of all three working together and sort of there was sort of this confluence of these three groups and whatever Epstein was doing, given the players involved and the things that were going on during this timeline. And so, you know, and given the fact that those are the three players involved, I think that also, you know, gives credence to the people that think he was murdered because, you know, a lot of times when, you know, operatives or, you know, people like even Robert Maxwell, right, become a liability for intelligence agencies, they usually get, taken out.
Sure.
It's really not that uncommon.
We'll go there in a little bit. But I want to keep working chronologically first, because I want to touch on that stuff, but I want to do it once we get to where we are now. So I think you're just doing a fucking awesome job so far. Can you get it?
Well, you know, my reports aren't written chronologically. They're written by they are to an extent, but not there's like some different threads that come at different times. So the part I'm working on now actually is the part about the Clintons and Mark Rich.
Okay.
I haven't published that part yet. So I haven't had to do any interviews yet where I sort of like put all of that in the chronological part of what Epstein was up to, right? Some of the reports that I've done talk about how you know, intelligence and the mob came together to form some of these sexual blackmail operations that were connected to Iran-Contra, and how some of those the people that were leading those rings had close ties to people like Roy Cohn. Including Craig Spence, who's that Washington lobbyist that was running the cowboy ring that took those midnight tours of the White House. A lot of people have seen that newspaper clipping just because the headline's so insane that, you know, these like underage boys that were being exploited were being sort of taken into the White House. It's like after hours is a really crazy story. To be honest, and that was apparently arranged by Donald Gregg, who was National Security Advisor at the time and had previously worked with Bill Barr at the Office of Legislative Counsel in the late 70s. So there's a lot of the same players and a lot of the stuff involved in other things besides Jeffrey Epstein, right? So when we're talking about just about Jeffrey Epstein, you see a lot of parallels between some of the stuff that we've gone over and some of the lives of these other some of the other people that were involved in this sort of stuff. Though I think Epstein is unique in the sense that he had a lot of, links or alleged involvement, you know, in finances and things like that. That is a bit different than some of these other people that I described in some earlier pieces in the sexual blackmail operations that they were running. To me, it seems like he sort of started off as some sort of like financial fixer, money launderer guy, and then got into the sexual blackmail stuff, but tried to do some of this finance stuff that he did before, like on the side, like with, currency trading and all of that, because he continued to do that with Deutsche Bank up until like, I think just a couple months before he was arrested. this past July. So I think that makes him a little different than some of these other people.
So do you think that Epstein was a pedophile all along, or do you think that it came as a result of maybe him getting involved in some type of sexual blackmailing and then, you know, either just by virtue of getting involved in it? Or, I mean, do you think this is something that, I mean, how old was Ghislaine Maxwell when he started dating her? And how old was she?
I think she was in her early 30s. I'm not sure how old he was, but I do know at the Dalton School, he, according to students that were there, they thought that he showed an unusual amount of interest in some of his, like, female students.
Okay.
So if he was, and that came out in some reports recently about his time at the Dalton School. So if he was showing those sort of interests there and then sort of got involved, you know, with like CIA stuff, and the CIA is really good at pinpointing if people have those sort of, you know, how can I describe
weaknesses.
It? Like divergent sexual tendencies,
right.
or weaknesses. They either, you know, try to exploit them or use them to their advantage in some way. So I think that may have been why he got, you know, picked for this at some point. And it's definitely true that Ghislaine Maxwell had a bunch of like weird sexual interests according to, you know, victim depositions, because she was, a lot of them say that Maxwell was involved in a lot of the sex and, you know, used all these toys, and she trained all the girls and how to pleasure men. And
right.
She was just like obsessed with sex. Right. So, you know, and she got involved with all of this in 1991. And actually Robert Maxwell was also super obsessed with sex. When he was working, you know, with the Mossad, they would just like give him a bunch of prostitutes whenever he asked. But even though he was working for them, the Mossad would record him anyway and like had this like what they said was like a small library of all these like videos and photos of Robert Maxwell naked doing ridiculous stuff in the bedroom.
And that's all been reported on already?
Yeah, well, these are in books about Robert Maxwell. That's from Gideon Spies by Gordon Thomas, who's a former investigative journalist for the BBC.
Okay, so take us from, you know, early 2000s to him, to Epstein striking a deal the first time. And you don't have to go super in depth with it if it's stuff that you haven't covered, but just for continuity purposes, walk my listeners up a little bit closer to that first deal he strikes.
Okay, so like the series that I'm writing is basically stopping at 2000, more like with like the Mark Rich pardon, really, is where I'm planning to stop it, because there's a bunch of connections to the people I talk about, the some sort of like 9/11 type stuff, and I don't that's like a whole nother can of worms. So I'm trying to stop it there. But you know, the early 2000s,
we're gonna
open
that can of worms, hopefully.
Well, I hope someone else should do it, but I don't I would like to write about something else for a couple of weeks. You know, the stuff is like really disturbing you know, to dig into for like so long and so in depth. I kind of feel like I want to take a break from it, go back to some of the stuff I was doing before. I mean, then there may be do some spinoffs, but who knows. But so basically in the early 2000s, this is when he meets up with, you know, in public anyway, with Prince Andrew and a lot of the famous people that surrounded him, though people like Alan Dershowitz, he met in 1996. And that was, again, through the involvement of Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, who I forgot to mention, by the way, she's tied into the whole Roy Cohn thing and Louis Rosenstiel, that mob guy that set up the sexual blackmail operation originally that Roy Cohn later took over. Through her first husband, with whom she had two sons, whose name is Andrew Stein, and he is the brother-in-law of Louis Rosenstiel's granddaughter, and they were represented by their lawyer was Roy Cohn, and Andrew Stein was super tied in to New York City politics and had connections to a lot of these same people. So that's I think that's worth noting. But anyway, a lot of the connections that Epstein made in the 90s were mostly done by Lynn Forrester, and she had, you know, Lynn Forrester's also super close to the Clintons, still is today, apparently, even after she, you know, got married to fancy, into the fancy Rothschild family of Europe or whatever. So she's an interesting character that I feel like has not gotten very much media attention and connection to all of this, even though she was very, you know, prominent in helping Epstein and by extension, Ghislaine Maxwell make a lot of important political connections. But anyway, going back to the 2000s, we have them, you know, partying with people like Prince Andrew. He gets involved with people like Bill Richardson. And, you know, most of the famous people that have come up in his like black book and all of that, most of those relationships, from my understanding, were cultivated in the early 2000s up until his first arrest. And a lot of those relationships even continued after his arrest, actually. You know, he had like a party when he got out of prison. A lot of these same people attended, even though it was known he was doing this. So I think that's a pretty damning, you know, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, this sort of behavior, even when it's aired out to the public, does not bother the elite like at all. They're like, oh, you're a pedophile and you sex traffic people. That's fine. Let's have dinner. You know, and they were doing that like after he got out of jail from the sweetheart deal or whatever. So, you know, all of that is pretty wild. So basically most of the activities that most people have heard about in the press in connection with the Epstein case, you know, his plane and all that stuff, that started in the 2000s. And that's when this whole sexual blackmail operation was in full swing. And of course, I say sexual blackmail operation to refer to Jeffrey Epstein, because we know that, you know, in the residences, not just the New York one, but also on the island and in Palm Beach, and most likely in the New Mexico one too, though it seems like the New Mexico one may have had a different purpose if recent press reports are to be believed. But all the other ones were bugged and had recording equipment, and Maxwell and Epstein both bragged about having all this dirt on people and that they had, you know, recorded famous people, and they'd sort of lured some of these people in and put them, you know, in contact with these underage girls, you know, to entrap these people, and that they also had huge collections of child porn, just massive collections. And it's also worth pointing out too that even though most of the victims that have come forward were preteens at the time, or were like in their teenage years but were still underage, there's also been, you know, photographs uncovered of prepubescent girls, and Jean-Luc Brunel, who was also one of the procurer for girls for Epstein, who's this, he owns a model agency in Europe, and he's like super, super creepy and super, he thinks like his like fetish is like raping sleeping women or something. The guy's like nuts. But he tried to get 2 8-year-old girls for Epstein from Europe. So, you know, this is something that it's not just preteen girls. Like, this is definitely like, this is the, there's a reason people are calling him like a pedophile, right? So it's like, this is really sick shit.
Yeah, that's insane. And then so he signs this deal, and then what you're saying is after the sweetheart deal, he invites these same people, throws a party.
A lot of them. Yeah.
Right. And then continue. What year was the deal signed, the sweetheart deal?
I think it was 2008. Or it might have been 2007. I mean, my series doesn't cover this
sure,
part.
Sure.
I'm mostly doing like the history, right? But it's in that ballpark.
Okay, but yeah. what your hypothesis is that these activities continued post that deal and were kind of in full swing at that point.
The blackmail may have continued, but his associations with all these powerful people definitely continued.
Okay.
Well, not all of them, but a lot of them. Some people tried to put distance between themselves, but others just didn't care, you know, and would go visit him in prison, even like Alan Dershowitz, or Ehud Barak, another good example. Ehud Barak was still visiting his house in like 2016. He brought in Epstein in like 2015 to be an investor in an Israeli tech startup with Ehud Barak and Peter Thiel. And so like, this is definitely like, you know, there were a bunch of prominent, powerful people in the US and abroad that had been connected to Epstein before the arrest, but they definitely weren't like grossed out by the fact that he was doing this stuff and he was publicly known to be doing this stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you think that at that point in the 2000s, late 2000s, early, you know, 2010s, that this sexual blackmailing was going on for Epstein's purposes or for the purposes of other people in intelligence? Do you think he was doing that on behalf of of another entity, or do you think he was doing it to protect himself?
I think this was definitely shared with people. I mean, obviously, I can't say exactly who, and the fact that Epstein's now dead, a lot of information that could have, you know, pointed us in the direction of where some of this information was going, specifically a lot of the electronics that were seized from these residences, that's not going to come out to the public now because the criminal case against him dies with him, right? So that us presumably would have been able to show if these pictures had been sent and where they had been sent and all of that, right? So that's not going to be coming out to the public. But given that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this guy was made to look like a billionaire. He wasn't actually a billionaire, and he was. I don't think that he was doing it for his own, you know, self-protection or whatever, and that this was just something he was doing in isolation. I think he was definitely sharing this with people, whether it was with, you know, these mega group oligarchs, or it was the CIA, or it was the Mossad. I think it could have been any of them, especially considering, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell's family. I think that, you know, definitely makes the intelligence angle and given Epstein's own past, I think, you know, that would make sense because those agency intelligence loves blackmail. They love to use it because it gives them so much leverage and they right. can, you know, get away with more stuff and they can manipulate people to do whatever with that blackmail. It's also been a longtime tool of the FBI as well. Right. So, you know, our government loves blackmail and it loves to use it. So I think he definitely had protection and was sharing it. And, you know, as to why he was arrested more recently, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation as to why
ask,
then.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I've heard a couple different theories, like that people wanted to pressure Trump to do certain stuff because of Epstein's relation to Trump. But I don't think that, I mean, it's mostly like an Epstein-Trump like friendship. I haven't really seen any evidence of Trump being like involved in the abuse of the girls. I do think like Trump has definitely done shady stuff. I'm not trying to say he hasn't. Right. But so I don't really buy that theory, though. I do think one thing that's interesting is that it does hurt some of the oligarchs, right, that are in the mega group, including Ronald Lauder, who I also in one of my reports connect a bit to Epstein. And he was a longtime friend of Roy Cohn and all of that. He recently turned against Ronald Lauder, used to be a longtime backer of Netanyahu, is often credited with getting him elected in 1996 when he first became prime minister. But in recent years, or I think like the past 2 years, he's like publicly rebuked Netanyahu and was planning to back Ehud Barak, who's like really close to Epstein, right? As I alluded to a bit earlier, and Ehud Barak right now is running in an election against Netanyahu. I think it's going to be, I can't remember, I think it's September when the Israeli elections are. But basically Netanyahu was facing like all of these corruption allegations for bribery and other stuff. And so like he was getting hit kind of hard by people like Ehud Barak, who, you know, was considered to be a major challenger to Netanyahu before all this Epstein stuff came out. But, you know, if you're running against someone who's accused of bribery, but you're accused of being the super best friend of someone who was a pedophile sex trafficker, bribery doesn't look so bad anymore, does it?
Right.
And also, Leslie Wexner is another one of those anti-Netanyahu guys in recent years as well, and this has put a lot of heat on Leslie Wexner as well. So there's some people that have speculated that this may have been a takedown for political purpose, perhaps. I do think it has certainly been convenient for Netanyahu, and I also think it's interesting that as soon as the news of Epstein's arrest broke, people connected to Netanyahu in Israel, politicians, including his son, Yair Netanyahu, were like, hey, you should ask Ehud Barak about Jeffrey Epstein, and were like on it in a second. I think that's kind of interesting. But I think, you know, the person who's, I would say, benefited the most from Epstein's arrest at the time when it happened would have been Netanyahu and people that backed the Likud party in Israel, because a lot of other people connected to Epstein, you know, so it was so bipartisan, and there's so many, you know, different people that were connected to him that I don't, in the U.S., it's hard to say like who was the biggest winner there, right? Because it ensnared Democrats and Republicans. So it's hard to say like, oh, this hurt, you know, the Democrats, or oh, this hurt Trump. I don't really think it significantly really hurt either side, if that makes sense.
Let's assume that Epstein is dead, right? Who benefited the most from him dying and from the criminal case being shuttered?
People not wanting the evidence that was collected to be made public, I think, or especially on the electronics, because it was known that a lot of this, the blackmail, it was all stored electronically, mostly on computers or hard drives. Things like that, and those were seized. Though I do think another potential thing that could have been a motive for Epstein's arrest is basically moving that blackmail that he was holding into different hands. For example, if you want to pursue the theory that he was more tied into the Mossad than the CIA, if you want to pursue this theory that he was more tied into the Mossad than the CIA, you know, there's this raid, and then the FBI and the Department of Justice gets all this blackmail that he had of picture of the pictures he had and the recordings he had of powerful people with underage girls.
Now, would our agencies be inclined to follow through on that? Or would they be inclined to use it for leverage? I mean, would they be inclined to...
Oh, no, they use it for leverage, totally. Oh, okay. For example, if they wanted leverage that, you know, if he was like mostly Mossad or whatever, if that was true, and I'm not making that claim, but if that was true, you know, and the FBI wanted it or something, and the FBI raids, you know, all of Epstein's residences, well, they have access to the blackmail too, or they at least know what Epstein had and was sending elsewhere, right? So I think the blackmail may have been a motive in and of itself, not really Epstein's activities or his associations, potentially. Especially if he was known to have had blackmail on a specific person that they wanted to target and couldn't get it from Epstein himself, and they had to go through. Hello?
Oh, yeah, I lost you just for a second. I'm sorry. Every once in a while you drop out. You know, we're speaking through super secure channels to Chile, so my listeners will they'll forgive me. Can we go back to the little 9/11 link that you just brought up, and just, even if you didn't investigate it, could you let my listeners know what thread they would want to pull on if they wanted to go down that road?
Well, one to start on is definitely Ronald Lauder. Ronald Lauder is there's a report that came out, and I'm inclined to agree with it, and I included it in my report as well, that he was actually the source of the Austrian passport that Epstein had, and Epstein claimed that he got that passport from a friend, right? And during the time he got it, Lauder was U.S. ambassador to Austria under Ronald Reagan, and had previously been Undersecretary of Defense for NATO and European Affairs, I believe, prior to then. And he was very tied into this Roy Cohn Trump group. But he was also a good friend of Larry Silverstein, and he was also instrumental in the privatization of the World Trade Center and all of that. A lot of people have, you know, fingered him for years as being sort of involved in what went on there. And he was also really close to, you know, Israeli politicians and things like that, for people that have, you know, investigated any sort of links between Israel and 9/11. And there's some other people too that were connected to Maxwell, like a person who, was seen on Maxwell's yacht on more than one occasion was John Lehman, who I believe was Secretary of the Navy for Reagan. And he later went on to be a member of the 9/11 Commission, which of course was one of those, you know, like the Warren Commission, just like set up to fail.
Right.
So there's a few other connections there as well, but those are the ones I'm remembering like off the top of my head. But there's also connections of these people to like the neocons. Like in my reports, I bring up names like Richard Pearl, Lynn Forrester to Rothschild has been friends with Elliot Abrams since the late 70s. So there were definitely, you know, neocon involvement in 9/11. You know, they were definitely connected to this network. And especially, you know, like Iran-Contra, that was like such a neocon thing, you know, and had like an involvement of a lot of neocons, and also involved a lot of collusion between the CIA and Israel. doing a lot of unsavory activity. And some people believe that those same forces were also involved in 9/11. So, you know, there's a I didn't investigate this in my report, but I did notice that, you know, there were some names that I'd seen before in connections to other people that do research 9/11 that had come up. But I am not one of those people.
Had you researched 9/11 on its own prior to this?
Oh yeah, but never to write about. Except I did write about the Dancing Israelis case when there was the recent FOIA request that got those heavily redacted pictures of the men that were arrested on 9/11 celebrating on the day of attacks, and they were linked to the Mossad, or two of them were, and they allegedly had foreknowledge of the attack. So,
very interesting. And that might be another podcast at some point. I'll keep it on Epstein, because that's what we're talking about. But I just had Richard Gage on from Architects and Engineers from 9/11 Truth, and we just had a fascinating podcast, because I've had a lot of questions.
Well, those are the guys to go to. I mean, those are the real experts that are honest about 9/11, right? So that was probably a totally awesome episode.
It was. You should go back and listen to it. It was fantastic. I mean, I've had questions mostly surrounding, you know, to me, I've always said for years, you know, I never brought it up publicly, and I finally just decided to talk about it on the podcast recently. But for, you know, a decade now, I've just been saying that Building 7 and all of the inconsistencies there will be the key that kind of unlocks the door. And I think we can wedge out a couple of mistruths there eventually over time, and then from there kind of pry the story open. I don't know how much you've looked at it in the past, but I don't know if you'd be inclined to agree with that.
Oh, with Building 7, you mean the building that fell down and the plane never hit? No, I mean, I've looked into this like for my own, out of my own interest, but I don't write about it for the outlet I write for. Though the outlet I write for editorially does not believe the official story of 9/11, but it doesn't make any claims as to this person did it or that person did it. It's pretty cool to work for a news outlet that embraces that view. It's not very common today in the U.S.
Yeah, well, I don't make that claim that I know who did it either. I just make the claim that to watch.
Well, some people do. I'm not saying you did, but yeah. I know there are some people out there that say these guys did it or these guys did it. You know, so
well, I try to walk the line up to kind of, you know, what do we have very clear evidence of, right? And you know, what can I see with my own two eyes? I see a woman on BBC reporting that the damn building fell down and it's standing up in the background behind her. Well, like, you know, I'm not going to, who am I going to believe, her or my lying eyes? You know, like the fucking thing's right there, you know, and I see that and I see a building that didn't get hit by a plane that most people didn't even know came down, with people with foreknowledge of it coming down, you know, at free fall acceleration. Like, you don't need to be a fucking physicist. It helps if you are, but like, shit. So let's go back to Epstein real quick. And God, I hope you come back on this podcast, because there's like 15 different things that I've jotted down here on the back of this envelope in front of me, because of course I'm prepared and I don't have any actual paper. And I'm like, shit, I gotta talk to you about this again. So I do hope you'll come back on. So let's talk about the death of Epstein and kind of what your thoughts are. I know maybe it's not something that you covered in depth. And actually, report just came across while we were on the podcast. Jeffrey Epstein shipped $50,000 cement truck to Pedophile Island 3 weeks before damning expose was released, paying for machine up front so it could arrive quicker, as experts say he could have, quote, literally covered up evidence. Just shipping the old cement truck overnight. You know, just happens all the time. What are your thoughts on the death? Talk to me.
Okay.
Is this a suicide? Well, what do you think?
So one of the things that really stuck out to me after he died is that even the mainstream media doesn't know what the hell's going on.
Right.
Right? So like usually they like all rally behind like one story like right away.
Right.
But they haven't done that. They've just been like saying all this contradictory stuff. I think that's really telling.
I do too.
Because this doesn't normally happen. Some people have said that this is intentional as a way to like muddy the waters. But I also think the timing is interesting, because there's no official story,
right?
Even if you believe mainstream media, because it's all contradictory. But everyone that doesn't believe the official story, that doesn't even freaking exist, is being, you know, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, right?
Right.
And this is also happening not long after the FBI and Bill Barr, who's tied up in a bunch of this, you know, crap, said, you know, or the FBI came out, which is under Bill Barr's jurisdiction anyway, and said that, you know, conspiracy theorists are a terror threat and all this stuff. But, like, wild, it's basically, right? Like, forcing everyone to be a conspiracy theorist, you know what I mean? Because even the mainstream media is, like, just giving so much fodder for conspiracy theorists. And also the fact that, like, the one of the guys doing the autopsy is Michael Baden, who's the guy that did, like, you know, crappy cover-up autopsies for, like, Martin Luther King Jr. and JFK and all this stuff. And then they put him on the Epstein autopsy. I mean, how is that, like, not... How are people not gonna? I mean, that's basically just like begging conspiracy theorists to freak out. You know what I mean?
And they still concluded that he broke this bone in his neck that is can be broken during suicide attempts, especially in older men. They said, but also is often broken in strangulation cases.
Right. So I mean, like I said, there's no official story, and I think that's really weird because that's not normally something that the mainstream media does. I mean, if you look at, like, either a false flag or other, like, prominent, you know, murder, suicides, or, like, suspect suicide, there's always a narrative.
Yeah, that was one of the things but that stood out to me immediately. Like, when I did a Periscope on the suicide the night that it happened, just like a little 10-minute thing with my thoughts. And usually what I'll do before I do one of these Periscopes or try to opine on things is I go through my news stations on the TV downstairs. And if you start at a certain channel, you can pretty much run the gamut of the major news organizations. You start at, you know, CNN, and then the next channel is, you know, whatever, Fox News, and then the next channel is MSNBC, and then the next channel is One America News, and then the next channel is something else. So I have like 5 or 6 of them. So what I'll do is oftentimes if I want to see who's covering what, and a lot of times I'll take photos for my Twitter and I'll say, look, this news just broke. Here's what each station is showing. Sometimes they're all the same, sometimes they're inconsistent, sometimes the left is saying one thing, the right is saying another. But I just find that fascinating to kind of take inventory of what the mainstream media is doing. So I did that. I went downstairs and I turned on CNN and I turned on MSNBC and I turned on Fox News, and I got the exact same feeling that you did. First off, all three of them were only covering it sporadically right after he committed suicide. So the news had officially broke. It hit the wire. I think NBC was the first to report it that I saw. And they had, all the stations were doing like these little like 2-minute hits on it, and they weren't staying on it, which A, I thought was interesting because it's really fucking bizarre. Like, it's one of those things that, like, in terms of fascinating people and in terms of news, like you're saying, how the fuck can you not be fascinated by it, right? So just to kind of dwell, well, hey, and then we'll go to the back to the El Paso shooter. We'll talk about something else. I thought that was fascinating. Second thing was, there was this bewilderment. Specifically, I remember watching an interview with, I think, Frederica Whitfield, and a woman that she was talking to was a former, somebody formerly involved in the prison system, whatever, trying to kind of figure out what had happened. And it appeared that the guest didn't know whether or not to try to defend the prison, didn't know whether or not to say this is a little fucky, and it turned into this amalgam of just kind of like, well, you know, what you gotta understand is sometimes there's certain times when, you know, things can go wrong, and he completed an assessment, a mental health assessment, and that's why he was taken off suicide watch. And then she goes back and saying, well, but yeah, it is very interesting circumstances. And, you know, what you just said resonated with me so much. It seemed like there was a lack of agreed upon facts, even basic agreed upon facts from the get-go. And when you combine that with the fact that this is obviously a bizarre story, it kind of, yeah. I mean, it gives you that impression. Like, do the powers that be that control these organizations, like, are they still trying to figure out... Are they fighting amongst themselves trying to figure out what the fucking narrative is going to be here, or what direction they're going to take this in? If, like, hey, we're going to continue to pursue the case here objectively, or hey, like, let's just fucking shut it down. All these people are involved. Like, it seems like there's a lot of fuzziness, right?
Right, totally. Another weird thing is that this prison is, like, super known for being corrupt. Like, if you pay the right price, you can, like, get whatever.
What is that so, like, based on?
Well, so like a year ago, there was this prison guard there at the same facility, MCC, that was convicted of taking $50,000 in bribes to smuggle all sorts of stuff to some gold trader that had been in prison there for some white collar crime offense. and had been caught smuggling all the stuff, and that was just last year. And apparently some other guy that was connected to the John Gotti, that like mob boss that was imprisoned in the 90s in the same place, he said that you can, you know, that prison is known for being able to smuggle all sorts of stuff in.
Yeah, I think a lot of prisons though have
right
those types
but,
of
I mean that's
right?
An angle that hasn't really gotten much coverage, right? Because they're trying to blame like, oh, it was understaffed, and then, oh, the guards were asleep, and, like, all this stuff, right? But it's totally ignored, like, the known corruption angle that was known to occur in that facility. So I think that's significant. So, you know, whatever happened, whether it was, like, murder or suicide or whatever, I mean, if you want to believe it was suicide, he was allowed to commit suicide. I mean, they obviously either paid people off or they, you know, got him help to kill himself. I mean, who knows, dude?
What do you think happened, and where do you think this is going to go from here? And just your opinion. You know, tell me your opinion.
Like to speculate on this, but I definitely don't believe the story about him like hanging himself with a bed sheet. That apparently at this facility, the bed sheets are like paper thin, and he was hanging himself from this bed. That if you look at the pictures that the media provided previously of what his cell looks like, it's like this concrete slab, basically. So kind of hard to like hang yourself that way when you're a 6 foot tall, like 200 pound and something man. I just think that, and then you break a bone in the process. I just think that's kind of bizarre. I think that the murder theory, it may make sense given the other people involved. Let's remember people like Robert Maxwell, right? Were killed off when they became liabilities, and it was staged to look like a suicide. And of course, there's a long history of several people, including those connected to, you know, some of the crime networks I detail in my reports, and some people that were trying to expose those same crime networks, you know, being suicided, right? Being like clearly the victims of foul play, but then they're desperate to suicide. Like a good example of that would be the journalist that was trying to investigate a lot of this corruption related to the Promise software that Maxwell was involved in selling, who was Danny Casolaro, who was found dead in 1991 when he was just about to break the story. And it was really clearly, to me anyway, Casolaro did not commit suicide based on the evidence there. And actually, I got some legal document where a confidential that cites a confidential source in government saying that he had been like that he had been murdered, basically. So you know, there's a history of like these powerful individuals you know, killing people and then saying it's a suicide. I mean, also another example that was trying to expose like the Iran-Contra network or what have you would be like Gary Webb, who was found dead of a alleged suicide, but he, you know, he was shot twice in the head. Kind of hard to shoot yourself twice in the head if you're committing suicide. So it's just like, you know, I think there's definitely something to that theory, but I also get kind of weirded out by the fact that, like, you know, even you know, that was my first inclination, but like some mainstream media outlets agree with me, and I'm like super not used to that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Don't worry about that.
That's part of the reason why some people I actually know and respect have actually gone out with this whole like he's not dead, he was swapped out theory. Which,
well, did you see the photos of him on the gurney?
I did, and it was weird. The nose thing, like the guy that was on that stretcher had a curved nose and Epstein didn't. So it's just like there's some weird stuff going on there. But who knows, man? With this sort of stuff and when intelligence or agencies are involved, there's always a ton of disinformation in the press.
Right.
There's always a lack of, you know, good information that comes out. That's like reliable to tell us what was actually going on. And the fact that there is no official narrative and all this stuff, that's been pointed to by the people that promote this whole swap out theory. If he was swapped out, it meant that he was important, dude. It meant that he, that they had a reason to like whisk him away and reassign him to something, or, you know, get witness protection program, facelift, whatever. That would have meant that he was actually kind of important. Not to just kill him off. So if that was the case, if it was murder, then they were just like, ah, fuck you. you're more trouble than you're worth sort of deal, you know? So it really depends on whatever, on his importance. And some people have pointed to the fact that there's like so much disinformation in media and no official story to get behind, to you know, support this whole swap out theory. But I, you know, I'm on the fence. I don't buy the, you know, official story of the suicide camp. I don't buy that. As to it was a murder or something, you know, the swap out thing. When you have the intelligence links, I mean, that just opens up a huge can of worms. You know right. what I mean? Because intelligence agencies do so much wild stuff that really anything becomes possible when they're involved when it comes to this sort of stuff. So I don't really know, dude, exactly what happened that night. But I think the fact that what it means going forward, it means that this criminal case goes away unless someone like Ghislaine Maxwell or Leslie Wexner are charged. And they're sort of setting up this narrative.
What's the likelihood
in the press.
Of that?
Well, they're basically, some outlets are starting to set up this narrative that, oh, Ghislaine Maxwell is going to cooperate and Leslie Wexner is going to cooperate. And then they, you know, whatever, they cooperate. And then if no other names come out, they'll just be like, oh, they're still cooperating. And then like nothing comes out ever again, you know what I mean? There's like no accountability anyway. So I think if they go the cooperation route, that's likely. I think that's likely because they're already trying to name that, you know, put that out there in the media right now.
Right.
Because a lot of people are like, why have you not found where Ghislaine Maxwell like even is?
Right. And now they're, you know, raiding, a lot of people are like outraged, the island like, after the fact, right?
Yeah, like over a, like, but like they waited to raid the island so long after he was arrested. They waited 2 days after he died. That's nuts.
Yeah, that's fucking ridiculous. What was going on the island in between them, right?
Exactly. Actually, there was this Christian news outlet and they sent two of their people to a ranch in the ranch in New Mexico that was owned by Epstein. And they were planning to go there before the news of the suicide broke. They were there on Saturday, the day the news of his death broke. And they went all around and they like looked inside a window and like the dishwasher was open. It was full of dishes and all these lights were on. All these cars were there. Or like there was a big RV and there was like a truck in another car. And then like dogs started barking and then they like ran and stuff. But that property has not been raided either. And there are definitely signs that someone is there. I mean, what are they doing?
That's a
why
great
isn't the FBI
fucking
question.
There? Right? That is a great question, right? Because normally in any other type of investigation like this, right, those would be the first places to be roped off, right?
Yeah. Or like as soon as he was arrested, it all should have been roped off and raided. I mean, the FBI has so many agents working for it and has such an insane budget. And it's an international pedophile sex trafficking ring. I mean, they really don't have the resources to do that. I mean,
you think this story is too big to make it public? You think it's too big for everything to go public? Ultimately,
I don't
like
know.
5,000
well,
foot
think,
view going forward. I mean, what are the odds it gets swept under the rug versus what are the odds it's a case that comes out and redefines a lot of what we think about a lot of things.
Well, I don't know. I'm like super cynical. just part of why
I
like don't live
you.
In the US anymore. because I think a lot of what happens going forward depends on like public outrage and public outcry. Because you know, if there's enough public outcry, they're going to try and pin it on some patsy guy, or they're
right.
going to try and pin it on some fall guy or some fall people. And if outrage keeps up after that, then they might go higher. But I think it's going to be a combination of public outrage and the media. I don't really see a lot of this coming from the mainstream media, so I hope you know there's a lot of stuff that goes forward from independent media about what Epstein was really up to, and you know hopefully there's no like other crazy event that goes on that totally distracts from this, like, you know, war with Iran or some other, you know, mass shootings
right.
and war with Iran are really the only things that will distract from this story. So that's kind of freaky in the sense that if the establishment gets freaked out that the story isn't going away, then maybe they'll try and, you know, they'd like something to happen, you know, that would, you know, distract attention from the Epstein case.
Yeah.
But it has to do with sustained public pressure, I think, and people that are willing to take the time and dig into the information that's out there.
And last
like what I did, you know, I did this with, you know, historical records and in a bunch of books and in the internet. So if I can do it, you know, anyone else can do it.
And, you know, last Sunday I tweeted out, if you think something is fucky with Epstein, the worst possible thing you can do is stop talking about it. And then I just wrote, you know, I bet my bollocks that there's many people hoping and praying this fades into oblivion now that the headline is hit. Serve those people a giant shitburger and don't let it happen. And,
yes, that's an excellent way to put it, right on.
So my last question to you, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time, and please, for the love of God, agree to come back on again some other time, because I have 50 million
other questions.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I feel like normally my interviews are I don't say so often, but like I've done like, I think this is my 11th interview since Epstein died on Saturday.
Ah, so you're busy.
And well, I just have like interview fatigue. I think I'm getting to that point. That's never happened to me before. I've never gotten so many interview offers.
I smoked a little pot before we started, and as soon as you started talking, I was like, oh fuck, I was like, there's no way I'm gonna be able to keep up with this. That's why I kept stopping you, and I was like, all right, can we just back it up like 10 seconds?
Yeah, sorry. Well, it's like a ton of info, right?
Next time I'm gonna mainline a couple coffees instead, and then I'll be zoned in on your level. Do you ever worry about, you know, getting too far into this? I mean, you just rattled off 10 minutes about journalists that have wound up missing and dead. Like, isn't this a great time to remind the world that we both like definitely don't want to commit suicide, and we're both like extremely happy?
I have. That's not something I've ever really been into, and I don't plan to do, obviously, but I'm not worried about, you know, anything mysteriously happening, because in this day and age, people like me and the outlet I write for, you know, we just get smeared as conspiracy theorists, and we'll just, I honestly think my reporting is just going to be lumped in with like other conspiracy theorists. You know what I mean? They'll just be like, you know, if it gets any mainstream traction, like I did an interview with the Jerusalem Post actually about Epstein Mossad ties like 2 days ago. That story still hasn't come out, but like if it starts to get sort of mainstream traction at that level, usually what happens is that they just smear Mint Press or they smear me. That's generally how it's been. So I'm just assuming, well, you know, they're just gonna go to that same playbook.
My listeners know better, number one. And they're, you know, a lot of my listeners come from the world of finance, and I started kind of what I'm doing, trying to expose a lot of bullshit that goes on in the financial industry. And so my listeners are cut from the cloth that, you know, they want the truth, and they understand, because the truth doesn't always line up with what they're being told from the mainstream media. That doesn't make you a conspiracy theorist. It makes you a fucking critical thinker, right? It makes you somebody that...
Yeah, well, I mean, like, obviously, that's what's going on. Well, I mean, conspiracy theorist has been, like, such a weaponized term since
it really
the CIA
has.
Weaponized it, you know, in, like, the 60s. So it's just... Well, actually, it even... Like, in the Korean War, the conspiracy thing really came out when people were trying to... blow the whistle on the use of the US's use of bioweapons in the Korean War. But then, you know, with the Kennedy assassination, it just like they were like, oh, you crazy conspiracy theorists, you know, that's where that whole thing really started, even though conspiracy is an actual charge that people like are accused with all the time. And Jeffrey Epstein, before he died, was facing a conspiracy charge.
Yeah, it's interesting. Before he died, I had this gentleman on named Dave Collum. And you should, I would encourage you to listen to this podcast. He's a Cornell professor of chemistry.
Yeah, I know who he is.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. So I had Colm on, and he's a friend of mine, and we were talking about a bunch of different conspiracy theories, quote unquote, because he had put out this tweet and said, yes, you know, I'm a conspiracy theorist. I believe that people with money and power often, you know, conspire to do things. And if you believe that and you don't say it, that makes you a coward, right?
Exactly.
So that tweet prompted me to want to do a podcast with him, and we did this awesome, like, basically 2-hour, 40-minute-long podcast where we covered a lot of things. We covered 9/11, we covered JFK, we covered the Las Vegas shooter, but the first thing we talked about was Epstein, because it was in the news. He hadn't died, you know, he hadn't committed suicide yet, but I think he had just been arrested, and, you know, Colm touched on a lot of things that you are... offering details on in a big way, which is the links to intelligence and things of that nature. So that podcast is available still on iTunes and on my Podbean, so you can check that out. But also, it got taken down from YouTube almost immediately for hate speech. They said this is violating our hate speech standards. Yeah, so I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I had to re-fucking do the whole thing and put it up on Vimeo, which was a huge pain in the ass. But it's just interesting. You know, it was 2 weeks ago we were talking about that and the potential implications of something like this. And the whole world, Whitney, 2 weeks ago joking around, like, hey, this guy's going to show up dead somewhere. And the fucking guy shows up dead. Like,
yeah.
Give me a fucking
break.
People
called this a long time ago.
Right. And we're the fucking conspiracy theorists. Give me a break. Give me a break.
Yeah. So.
Anyways, all right. Well, I'm happy to report that we are both in good spirits and we are stoked about living for a very, very long time to come.
Oh, yeah, super long. That's my plan. So I can, you know, give the finger to these, you know, assholes involved in the Epstein thing and all those other, you know, shady activities that go on in the world of
God. Will you
the
please...
intelligence community and all that stuff. So I hope to stick around for as long as possible so I can just keep sticking it to them.
Will you please, please, please come back on the podcast? By the way, I can already feel... like, just from this podcast, like, 5,000 Twitter followers incoming. Like, just get ready for your shit. Your shit is going to get blown up, like, totally by my listeners.
Well, I mean, that would be cool. I mean, honestly, I kind of hope I get deplatformed because I hate social media. But, I mean, it always is kind of rewarding to get more followers, I guess. So, that would be cool.
Well, if you're ever in the States... First Beer in Philadelphia is on me, and I can't thank you enough for coming on, and please tell me you will come on again at some point.
Yeah, I'll come on again, no problem.
All right, just awesome.
You can follow my articles at mintpressnews.com if you find anything that interests you that I have written, just let me know.
Yeah, well, I have you on push alerts on Twitter now, and everybody else should do the same thing. And what I'm going to do is put your bio page and everything in the podcast description so people can link right to it. And if you want a second to, you know, plug your outlet and say the nice things about it that you did prior to when we got started, you're more than welcome to do that now.
Oh, okay. Well, all my work is published at mintpressnews.com. I write exclusively for them. Technically, it's a website editorially that's anti-war and anti-empire. Currently, though, I'm the only not progressive writer.
Congratulations.
That's why I like to say it's like a mix, right? So you get a mix of different perspectives, but generally speaking, we try and be objective regardless of our, you know, political ideology and just or just pretty much against neoconservative foreign policy, empire and war, which is something that is shared by people on the left and the right. We try and appeal to people on both sides to sort of rally them about those things, which is why we generally don't cover things like Jeffrey Epstein, but the whole intelligence angle, I mean, yeah, that that changed the game, at least as far as I was concerned. So, check us out. We're on Twitter and Facebook. I'm hoping to get us on a different social media platform like that BitTubers one that just started up. That seems pretty promising. So, follow us on there. And you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook. Put me in Facebook jail and doesn't let me post anything since like April.
Facebook did.
So, yeah.
For what?
Yeah, I can... they wouldn't let me share links to Mint Press every time I would like... post a link to my article on my author page, they would say that I was abusing the feature.
Man, fuck these motherfuckers. Seriously.
I was like, I just want to post one thing. Like, I hit the button once, and they're like, you're abusing the post button.
It's just getting insane. Out of hand. And it's getting so out of hand that it's bleeding over, and the masses now, the public who aren't even thinking about this shit critically, are starting to get wind of the fact, you know, this thing comes out 2 days ago. Facebook's now transcribing audio recordings of your phone calls with people. It's like, hello, isn't that like a fucking felony, like wiretap law crime? Like, the fuck is going on?
There's the government backdoor and encryption coming, courtesy of Bill Barr, who predicted just 2 weeks before the El Paso shooting that a major incident would soon arrive that would galvanize public opinion about the end of encryption. So definitely something for interested listeners in that whole perspective to look into. I wrote about that actually after part three of my series came out. So if you go to my author page of Mint Press News, you can read all about Bill Barr's Orwellian and strangely predictive speech of the El Paso shooting.
Oh my God. Please just let me know when you have another 2 hours and we'll just go. We'll just see where we wind up. All right, Whitney Webb, thank you very much for taking 2 hours out of your day for me and for my listeners. I appreciate you, and I know they do too.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Whitney. That was the incredible Whitney Webb, and holy shit is my fucking mind blown. First off, I am so stoked just to know that there's fucking people out there like her, number one. Number two, holy shit. Can you believe all that shit she just said? And number three, if I turn up dead somewhere after this podcast goes live, just know that I'm fucking pissed and it sucks. And and I didn't kill myself because that was some wild shit. And wow, I can't wait to do it again. All right, for now, I'm the fuck out of here. I got great stuff coming up this weekend. Stay tuned for Saturday. I got a mystery guest coming on, unless they cancel, which all my guests do. Because I'm the worst podcast in history, fools. I'm out of here. Peace.